This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, Blood and Oil, my guest Michael Clare warns that U.S. foreign policy increasingly revolves around access to oil, and our military is being converted into a global oil protection service. It's not just our relationship with countries in the Middle East that is focused on oil, Clare says. Oil is also the focus of our relations with countries in Africa, Central Asia, and South America. Clare is a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, and is the defense correspondent for The Nation. He says that 60% of our oil is imported, and that figure is likely to keep rising, which will make us even more reliant on the Persian Gulf producers. So the U.S. has a vested interest in getting Iraq production to where it was before the war. I asked him if he thinks the war in Iraq was predominantly about oil.
Oil has many guises to it. It's a source of fuel, it's a source of wealth, and it's also a source of power, political power, immense power, because whoever controls the flow of oil from the Middle East controls the heartbeat of the world economy. If that heartbeat is damaged, the whole world economy suffers. So controlling that is crucial. And I think from the minds of people in Washington, from the Bush administration, it was that aspect of oil that drove the war in Iraq, to ensure that the United States and nobody else, no hostile power, would ever control the heartbeat of the world economy as represented by Persian Gulf oil. And if you read the statements of people in the administration, they talk that way, especially Vice President Dick Cheney, who said that we can't allow anyone else to have the ability to strangle our economy by threatening the flow of oil. So it was to protect the flow, I believe, that the war was really all about.
Let's look at America's relationship with Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, in some ways, stand for the things that we oppose. It's an authoritarian government. It's a fundamentalist Islamic government. The women in Saudi Arabia have very little in the way of rights. I mean, they're not even allowed to drive. And yet, the American and Saudi governments have a very close relationship. What are some of the ways that the Saudis and the Americans have helped each other over the years?
Now, this is an arrangement that goes back more than 50 years to the administration of Franklin Roosevelt. It was FDR who first determined that the United States had to have a close relationship with the Saudi royal family, and he met personally with the founder of the dynasty, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, in February 1945, and the two leaders, the President of the United States and the King of Saudi Arabia, worked out an arrangement whereby the United States would protect the royal family against all of its enemies in return for privileged American access to Saudi oil. And this arrangement has been the driving force behind American foreign policy in the Persian Gulf ever since. And it means that we, that is, Americans, bear responsibility for defending the regime, not only against foreign enemies like Iraq or Iran, but also from internal enemies. So the United States is implicated then with the repression in Saudi Arabia, with the ever-present security forces that suppress dissent, which makes us a target for those who seek to overthrow the regime, like Osama bin Laden. We are directly implicated in the survival of the royal family.
How vulnerable do you think the royal family is now?
Bear in mind that we're talking about a group of 5,000 people, the princes and princesses of the House of Saud, who control all of the country's wealth and who make all the fundamental decisions about what goes on in the kingdom. And there are 15 million other people in Saudi Arabia who have no political rights, no political representation, no right to dissent. And I personally believe this is an arrangement that cannot stand for very much longer. In the 21st century, with satellite TV and travel and communications, sooner or later, the people of Saudi Arabia are going to demand the same rights that people have in other parts of the world. And the royal family has shown no willingness whatsoever to compromise with those calls. And so I think this is a very volatile, dangerous situation. In addition, the royal family is well aware that there are strong currents of dissent within their society. And because they don't allow any public expression of dissent, there's no freedom of speech or assembly or of the press, that dissent takes underground forms. It's hidden in often dangerous forms, violent forms. And in the hope of trying to take that violence and direct it not at the royal family but outside, elsewhere, they finance these fundamentalist groups in Pakistan and Afghanistan and elsewhere and encourage young Saudis to go to those areas for education and so forth. And it's a way to deflect that hostility away from the royal family and towards the outside world. And unfortunately, the United States became a target of that hostility and violence. That wasn't the intent. The intent was to protect the royal family, but that was the consequence of it.
Well, let's move away from the Gulf for the moment and look at some of the other parts of the world. There's something called the alternate eight. So these are like eight countries that aren't part of the Middle East or the Gulf, but are rich in oil. What are those countries?
What I call the alternate eight are the countries cited in the Bush-Cheney energy policy of May 2001 as alternatives to reliance on Middle Eastern oil. And the eight are Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, Angola, Nigeria, and Kazakhstan, Russia, and Azerbaijan. So they're concentrated in the Western Hemisphere, in Africa, and in the Caspian Sea, former Soviet Union.
Well, let's look at the former Soviet Union and that Central Asian area, which is rich in oil. Who is competing for the oil in that part of the world now?
Everybody is competing for that oil because we're at a time in the evolution of the world economy where the older industrial countries need more oil, but we're seeing the emergence of new industrial powers, especially China, but followed by India and South Korea and Taiwan, that also need large supplies of new oil. And they're looking very closely at the Caspian Sea region as a possible source of additional oil and natural gas. On top of that, this used to be in the sphere of influence of the Tsarist Empire and then the Soviet Empire. And today's leaders in Russia are unwilling to give up control over what they see as their traditional sphere of influence. So you have the Western countries, the rising Asian industrial powers, and Russia all competing to control this one area. And I see it as the pivot of international conflict for the coming decades.
Because we're all competing for access to that oil?
Because we're all competing for access or control over that oil, and all of these powers are meddling in local affairs. The United States is forming military ties with countries in the region. Russia is doing everything it can to hold on to its control of the region, and China is now acting in a similar manner, forming ties with some of the Central Asian countries, providing them with military aid, sending in troops and advisors. So you have one region in the world that has the three great powers of the 21st century, the U.S., Russia, and China, all competing for influence at the same time. And we know that right now there's a lot of violence in Chechnya. Well, Chechnya is right in the corner of this region. And I'm convinced that the Russian authorities have been so adamant in their determination to control Chechnya by whatever means necessary because they view it as crucial to their part of this competition. And I think that's why the Chechnya violence is so intense and brutal and violent.
Let's look at Africa for a moment, another area rich in oil. What are some of the foreign policy decisions that have been made in the past few years that you see as being connected to protecting our oil interests there?
Well, the largest producer in Africa is Nigeria. And Nigeria could be an even bigger supplier to the United States in the years ahead. So it doesn't surprise me that that's the country that has received the most attention from the Bush administration over the past few years, other than South Africa, which is an industrial power. But Nigeria has had a lot of attention. Senior Bush administration officials have been over there. We're sending a lot of military assistance. We're increasing our military aid to the Nigerian military. And I think that this is connected to the perception that the oil flow from Nigeria is very vulnerable to instability in the country. There are a lot of ethnic disputes. There are a lot of animosities to the government for siphoning off all of the oil wealth. And I think that the administration in Washington is very worried about instability in Nigeria and so is stepping up its military assistance to that country.
Let's move towards South America and look at the U.S. relationship with Colombia. I think most Americans, when they think of Colombia, they think of drug trafficking and all of the political and economic problems revolving around that. But Colombia is also a potentially big source of oil for us. So how do you think oil is affecting the U.S. relationship with Colombia?
Oil in Colombia could be an important source of petroleum for the United States in the future. But most of Colombia's oil is in very remote areas in the northeast on the border of Venezuela, far from ports in the Caribbean where it could be exported to the United States. And the only way to get that oil from those remote areas to those ports is by pipelines. And the major pipelines go right through the heart of guerrilla-infested areas. So they're very vulnerable to attack. And in fact, the guerrillas have attacked the pipelines hundreds of times over the past few years, making it very difficult to deliver that oil. So to protect the pipelines, the United States has now deployed a team of special forces instructors to train and equip whole new brigades of the Colombian Army whose sole mission will be to protect these vital pipelines against attack. And it's likely that Americans are playing a very critical role in these pipeline protection operations.
You basically say in your book that you think the U.S. military has a new role now, and it's basically to protect oil resources.
That's right. I think as this country becomes more and more dependent on oil from very unstable parts of the world, and so long as we retain our addiction to oil as the main source of energy, American leaders seem determined to use military force whenever necessary to protect those overseas sources of oil. And let me say, this is not just a Republican policy. It is a policy that both parties and leaders of both parties have pursued over the past few decades. So it's not a new policy, but it's being globalized. And that's why we now have American troops in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia protecting pipelines, in Colombia protecting pipelines, in Iraq protecting refineries and pipelines. This is what I think more and more the American military is going to be consigned to do.
What are some of your biggest long-term concerns about American foreign policy being so involved with our oil concerns and the American military being so concerned with protecting our oil supplies?
What worries me, first of all, is that there's no end in sight. We're becoming increasingly dependent on imported oil. And as I say, more and more of it is coming from some of the most dangerous areas of the world. So as long as we view oil as a national security matter, that means that American military involvement in these areas is destined to grow. And the risk to American soldiers who were sent over to these places to protect the pipelines and the refineries, they're going to face greater and greater risk. And so simply on a moral level, there's, in my mind, a question whether this is a legitimate risk to ask our men and women in uniform to take, to protect pipelines simply to support our addiction to cheap petroleum. It seems to me that it would be far more morally appropriate to invest not in more military forces, but in alternative sources of energy so that we don't have to send young men and women over to risk their lives to protect the flow of petroleum.
Okay, you've addressed what you see as moral issues. What about just like hardcore political issues? Do you think that there's any problems we might run into in the long run from forming so much of our policy around oil concerns?
Yes. My big worry is that this can become the new driving force in international conflict among the great powers. And here we come back to Central Asia and the Caspian region as a pivot of world affairs. As China becomes more and more like us in being dependent on imported oil, and as Russia tries more and more to control the flow of oil from the region, you have the risk of great powers colliding with one another through their involvement in local affairs, colliding with each other directly in a way that we haven't seen for a very long time. There hasn't been a period where Americans have faced Russians and Chinese head-on in an area of conflict, and that's what we're facing in the Middle East and in the Caspian area. And this is what worries me more than anything else.
So how do we solve the problem? I mean, do you see any way of detaching foreign policy from our need for oil?
I think the problem is that we have securitized oil in this country, by which I mean we've said it's a matter of national security. And when you say something is a matter of national security, as President Carter did in 1980 in the Carter Doctrine speech, it means you're prepared to send troops overseas to protect it. And that has been the instinct of American leaders ever since. I think we have to say that oil is not a matter of national security, and that we no longer are going to tie our military strategy to the protection of overseas oil regimes like Saudi Arabia or Azerbaijan or Kazakhstan, that that's not the function of the military, and that in order to do and to do that, to be honest, we're going to have to reduce our dependence on petroleum, and that means developing alternatives. And that's going to require leadership at the top.
What would you like to hear the president say about oil dependence?
This is what I'd like the president to say. The president has to say, listen, my fellow Americans, we've become addicted to a substance, petroleum, that is vital to our economy and has contributed to our prosperity. But we no longer produce this substance. It comes from elsewhere, and more of it is going to come from elsewhere. And if we continue down this path, we're going to pay a very high price in human lives to keep on in this direction. And therefore, we have to change our ways to accommodate the reality that we are no longer supplying ourselves with this substance. And that means we all have to take steps to move away from petroleum addiction and move in new directions, particularly in the development of alternative means of transportation like hybrid vehicles and hydrogen-powered fuel cells. I don't think that's such a hard thing for the president to say.
The Bush administration is connected to the oil industry. The Bush family has been in the oil industry. Vice President Cheney had been the head of Halliburton. So I'm wondering how you think their connections to the oil industry has affected policy.
What worries me about the Bush administration's ties to the energy industry is the particular nature of those ties. They're very closely aligned with big oil and big coal and the nuclear power industry, especially those parts of the energy industry that want to perpetuate the current energy paradigm in this country of a lot of oil consumption, a lot of coal consumption, even more nuclear power. And it's very clear that this society has to move in new directions towards alternatives to those fuels. And the fact that they're so closely tied with these old industry models means they are freezing us in a dysfunctional energy system. And we're going to pay a very high price for this down the road, when oil becomes more scarce and the environmental effects of using coal become even more hazardous than they are today, I think they did us a terrible disservice in their energy report in 2001 of not moving much more rapidly and aggressively towards a post-petroleum, post-coal economy energy system that would give us the paradigm we will need in another 20 or 50 years.
Well, Michael Clare, thank you very much for talking with us.
Gee, Terry, it's been a great pleasure for me.
Michael Clare is defense correspondent for The Nation. He teaches at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. His new book is called Blood and Oil.